everyone. Welcome to another Bounty episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre with me in the city. In this episode, we have an interesting post on auditing methodology, an FTP bug that can yield remote command execution, and a Kubernetes issue. First, though, we're going to start off with Microsoft announcing that they have started a Defender bounty program for Microsoft Defender and all the products and whatnot that are under that branch. And I'll let Z get into some of the specifics here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to dive too deep into it, but it looks like they're basically just expanding the Microsoft bug bounty program to include going after Defender, after the Defender for like endpoint APIs and all of that, which hasn't previously been in there, offering between, you know, a pretty big range there, $500 to $20,000. Obviously, that depends on what you find, but Defender can be an interesting target. I know a lot of people kind of look at it on the side when it comes to like red teaming and stuff. So if you want to claim some bounties out of some of that work, you very well might be able to find something. So I just wanted to shout it out as like a new addition there. I know we don't usually cover like just new bounties, but I did think Defender is a kind of interesting enough area to look at that I at least wanted to shout it out.
And we like to call out the Microsoft ones just because generally they do pay out pretty well, especially compared to a lot of other bounty programs. And I do want to mention some of the just scope and what they're looking for. So for remote code execution, they're offering 10 to 20K on critical and 5 to 15K on important, escalation of privilege and info leak, 3 to 8K and 1 to 5K respectively, and spoofing and tampering is 500 to 3,000. And denial of service is out of scope, which is not super surprising. The other thing I want to call out here, as I do kind of like this, is they also tailor the payouts to the report quality. So those higher pay, like the higher end of those ranges is not only dependent on the severity, but it's also on the report quality. So they encourage you to write good reports, which I think is a nice thing because it does like, that is a bit of a problem in the bounty space, I find, is sometimes you can get these really like difficult to understand reports and it causes friction between the developers and the researchers. But with the way that Microsoft like has a monetary incentive for doing the higher report quality, I do like to call that out. And, you know, it's something to be aware of and it's a good incentive to, you know, write up a really nice report. So
yeah, on the flip side, then, you know, can kind of feel bad if you report something over to Microsoft and it's like, this wasn't a good enough report, so you're not getting the bonus or whatever. Like, there is,
it can be a double-edged sword too.
Yeah, and you don't really have much room to be like, no, that was totally a perfect write-up, absolutely wonderful. Like, it's kind of their discretion on it. But that is something I think Microsoft does in general with their reports. Report, having the proof of concept, having a lot of that, and actually understanding the bug versus just reporting here's a bug. I don't know if it's a security vulnerability, but I'm reporting it as one. And that's sort of a almost big bounty type of report.
Yeah. So I did want to like make mention of that. But yeah, I mean, the payout table is pretty nice here. And like you said, Defender is an interesting target. It's something that's shipped on most, if not all, Windows PCs, so it's a pretty important target too.
My apologies, actually. I guess in my excitement over thinking this is going just against Defender, it looks like they are just starting this out just focusing on the Defender for endpoint APIs, although they will expand it to other things in the Defender brand over time. I had missed that initially. I thought this was starting with a larger scope. It does sound like they're going to be rolling that out, so I guess something to pay attention to if it interests you. I mean, the Defender for endpoint APIs maybe isn't the most exciting thing quite right now, but Defender in general, I think, is an interesting area. But yeah, I did miss that and just notice it, so my bad.
Fair call up. All right, so getting into a simple issue, we have an API exposure issue in an undisclosed telecom company. A bit of a fun story, and the reason it's undisclosed is because it was basically required if they wanted to write up the issue, or the company really didn't want to be disclosed, because it was kind of a silly issue. So I'll let Z get into it.
Yeah, I mean, this is about as easy of an issue as you can run into. You've got, it's a network camera, more or less what you would expect, interacts with the server. So they have several APIs going forward, and most of those APIs are authenticated. However, they came across and just testing basically all of the APIs, came across one that was in fact unauthenticated, and that one unauthenticated thing contained the event string for the camera. So anytime there's an event that wants to maybe alert on or something, and it's going to include the picture of whatever happened. So I'm imagining this is like your motion detection sort of alert where it's like, hey, something moved or sound or whatever, and it sends you that image. It would include the image along with the base 64 of the actual file, just an adjacent blob. These server sent events would just send the blob out to whoever's on that page. So, yeah, I mean, very straightforward, very simple issue, just the lack of authentication. I kind of want to call it out more or less just as a reminder to actually look at some of these things because a lot of times you just expect. There are going to be things like they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't be that stupid in terms of how they implemented something. And then you go and check your assumption and you're wrong and they actually were. That is what the case really is here. Like this isn't some really crazy vulnerability to learn from. This is just your regular reminder that plenty of applications still mess up just authentication. And I mean there probably is the intent on this being, well, we want like the app to always work so we can like have authentication, have them timed out and not get the alert or something like that. I can understand some argumentation on that, but I think there are better ways to do that, like just including a token that the app knows and has to share when making the request. Then the page can't just be predicted, it has to actually have like the token or something along those lines. Even if the token were a long expiration, which also isn't great. It's a lot better than it's a lot better than the alternative of just having it public and very predictable here. So yeah, I just wanted to call it out. I imagine, or I'd hope most of you are already kind of testing for that as you do bug bounty. If not, they're pretty easy tests to run. Just make all of your requests with without cookies, and you should be able to see if a website is serving you up the same endpoint when you don't even have any authentication cookies. Unless they're using something else for authentication, there's probably some edge cases on that, but generally speaking, it's not too hard to test.
Right, and continuing on with some issues with authentication, we have a post by Converge on a critical vuln in Crush FTP, and I'll let Z get into it.
Yep, I'll take this one again.
Yep, you just got a train of vulnerabilities. I'll chime in
Yeah,
eventually.
I've got these too. Yeah. So if you've used a FTP before, you might be familiar with the idea of anonymous accounts. Just like if you're not authenticated, but they still want to have some access, or like you can still access some directories or whatever, there are anonymous accounts. It was more common, I think, in the days where people were actively like using FTP for file sharing. These days, it's been a long time since I've really needed to like FTP to grab a file. Like usually people just put it up on like, Dropbox, Google Drive, they'll have kind of the access to it. But
I've seen it once or twice for pulling PDFs from like some university sites, but yeah, it's pretty rare to see
yeah, I mean
FTP on the web.
university sites actually are probably one of the more common things. You'll get the same thing with FTP to pull down like Linux ISOs and VMs and stuff. They'll sometimes be serving that over FTP. And the main reason there, I believe, is because it is technically lighter, like has less overhead on the actual transfer. I don't know how the true that is when you get into like HTTP 2 or HTTP 3, but generally, like FTP is technically a little bit better, I think. Maybe not with the newer protocols, but it was, and that's why it was used. Anyway, with Crush FTP, they also have a web interface, so the primary part of this attack is actually using the web interface and not going over FTP, so a lot of that doesn't matter, but the anonymous user aspect does. And they call this out here as like anonymous users kind of tend to blur the line when you're looking at authentication, because you end up in that case where you have this user account in a sense where you're connected as a user, it's just that user is supposed to be very limited and not really a user. It turns out Crush FTP, some places will just do checks for a username, although when it comes to authorization checking, they do generally refer to whatever role the user has, so like the anonymous account isn't really getting a lot of extra privileges there. But they did find a vulnerability in the unauthenticated area where basically coming in on this server session Ajax page, I'm not sure if that's, I don't recall offhand what the actual endpoint was that hit that, if that was this web interface one, or if that was just whatever. But handling, it's a very early part of the request, handling incoming requests and processing all of the headers coming in. Importantly, it's pulling out headers as part of, or it's looking for headers correlating to the AS2 protocol, which I'm not familiar with, but it parses these things like, or it's parsing them out of the HTTP headers into this AS2 info, and that's just properties, so kind of like a hash map or something, and store, but I think they eventually end up typecasting it into a map, so storing data in that sort of key value way. So they end up picking off the headers and doing that, nothing too crazy, they're parsing headers. But if the AS2-2 header is present, they have this check here. If it's not, or if they get the property and it's not equal to just an empty string, then they'll fall into this other code. And importantly, what it ends up doing is, so it's parsed all of the headers out of the request, parse all of those into it, and then it puts it all into this user info, calls put all, and put all is basically taking every key out of that AS2. It's going to iterate over every key and just add it into user info. So it's a mass assignment sort of issue, and user info, as you might guess, contains a lot of the user info. So it does contain like the username in there. For the purposes of the exploit, it also contains some logging information. The username wasn't as powerful to override as you might think, because the user, like, authorization information, all the roles, is in a different variable that isn't the user info. So you can overwrite user info, so anything that's checking for particular usernames could be bypassed, but all of the authorization checks use something else, so they couldn't. But inside of this user info, which is still relatively powerful, I think they show it having, like, quite a few nodes here. Thing breaks down, showing up to like 255 values inside of the hash map that we're talking about. Although not all of those are necessarily filled, because that 256 is a suspiciously round number, so might just be allocated to that size initially. But they do call it contains things like username, IP, and just session information if they're currently logged in, user ID. Again, contains user info. What they were able to do with that is they could basically take control over any value inside of user info, because this put all method that I mentioned doesn't do any sort of security check. It's just every key in one goes into the other. These keys are coming from the header, so attacker control can control basically all those values. So what they ended up going for with their attack was to target and they're going to make reference to this UISG function a little bit if you do go read this. That is basically just taking in a string as an argument, and then if it's in the user info, returns it from the user info. So it's just kind of a proxy around getting something out of user info. So if I refer to it, that's kind of what's going on here. But they use that and end up targeting some of the logging information. So inside of this user info, it did contain like a user log path, a user log file. And one of the important kind of primitives that they found was user log path custom. And this basically would copy files. It basically gave them an arbitrary file copy primitive, because it would take this user log path custom and saying like, hey, I want to move this user's logging file and I want to move it to this location, and you would provide in that path custom. When it sees that, it would go and take the old path sitting in user log path, would take that file, copy it to the new location, creating any directories, and then delete the original file. So file deletion and a file copy. They could copy basically any file using this, because you can control both the source and the destination value. Copy any file to any location and delete the original. Using that, they could leak information like the, if there were any static users. The user XML file, as long as they could find where that file was, they could leak like that and get the internal or file system based users can get that information. Giving them kind of a file read to dump anything, or basically writing any file there. So the way they mostly, or the other way they abused that was the sessions object or .obj file. This user would log in, they may be able to get their account token to basically hijack that user's account. And basically went from there. So fairly powerful attack. I do like these mass assignment sort of issues. This one's a little bit restricted and that's only going inside of the user info, but they're kind of a fun issue because you have to explore a lot when you run into it. Like, yes, you can control everything, but what does it actually do? And they did run to some dead ends. Like, the username is a very obvious target to go and corrupt. And in this case, they couldn't actually get much with that because authorization was checked based on something else they couldn't overwrite. So you kind of have to come up with these other techniques. Like in this case, they use that logging. So just fun to kind of get the exposure to how somebody did take advantage of it. Pretty much every case of one of these issues is going to be different, but it gives you some ideas on how you might be able to go forward with it.
Yeah, it's always nice to have things that you can refer to for inspiration. So, yeah
it's a fun issue. And I do want to actually shout out at the top, they talk about that anonymous user and kind of getting access to stuff. Just because of that something I've talked a bit about in the past is just like testing from all the different states that you can be in these weird edge states. So I've mentioned that when it comes to like 2FA bypasses when you're partially logged in and what you can do in that state. Because sometimes that state will actually be completely authorized or something. But those edge cases, so anonymous is kind of an edge case of authorization, are good areas to kind of keep an eye out for.
Yeah, and I think that sort of idea is something we'll circle back to for our last topic with methodology. All right, so we'll move on to our Kubernetes issue. So this was a bug in the Ingress Nginx controller for Kubernetes. So up front, like, I'm not too into cloud stuff. I don't really use Kubernetes, and I imagine some listening may not be either. So just to explain some of the terminology, Ingress is essentially an API exported via HTTP or HTTPS that allows external accesses to services in a cluster or a group of nodes from outside of that cluster. And to handle Ingress routes, you need to have an Ingress controller, and Ingress Nginx is one of the most common ones. The problem here comes into play when an attacker is in a position to create or update Ingress objects, which can have annotations attached, which can have some pretty powerful and dangerous functionality. The one that's relevant here, though, is the content by Lua block, which straight up just allows you to pass in Lua that gets executed, which in this case for their POC would set up a reverse shell, which would allow the next Ingress to pass in a command that gets executed. So again, kind of on the theme of the episode, pretty simple issue. It's just, they tried to do some filtering of the directives that are getting passed in, but they just missed this one. And ultimately, after this issue was reported, it seems like they just completely stripped the support for these kinds of annotations because it seems fraught with peril to try to support them in a secure way. So, I think this content by Lua block trick has been written up before and has been used in some other Ingress modules. But yeah, in this case, it was in Ingress Nginx.
Yeah, so I will mention here that the actual annotation that was a problem was configuration snippet, because what you're doing with this is you're providing an annotation to the node and you're saying, like, you should add to Nginx Ingress Kubernetes this configuration snippet, and then it copies that configuration snippet into the Nginx config. And then inside of that Nginx config, that's where the content by Lua block comes. That is a Nginx feature. To support serving, like, you give it a location, or you use this as part of a location grouping. I don't know. There's a proper name for that, but part of the location, you'll give it that, and you'll say it's, like, served by this Lua code giving arbitrary code. So content by Lua isn't actually from, like, Kubernetes. That is part of Nginx. And then the issue kind of arises in the fact they have this configuration snippet. And yeah,
my bad. I did miss that step. Yeah,
I found it interesting how They did have, like, so they do have a little bit of protection against other things. Like, you can't provide a root directive, you can't provide a alias directive, because those are, like, you set the folder where it's going to read files from, and that could, like, you, like, look at other locations that you shouldn't be seeing or shouldn't have served. So they actually had previously removed those completely from their Nginx support. They basically have a patch Nginx, or several Nginx patches, that will remove, like, directives completely. So it's interesting that they remember to get the, you know, server and the alias ones, but left in content by Lua. So it's one of those oversights, and I think it's slightly understandable. Like, I use Nginx a fair bit. I've run into content by Lua, like, a handful of times, mostly in the context of, like, a CTF and stuff. So, like, I'd understand a developer not being aware that that is an option that could even be there.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it. Like, I don't do a ton of Nginx configuration, to be clear. Like, I've done it maybe 3 or 4 times that I can remember. But, yeah, I've never seen the content by Lua support.
Yeah, I've never used it. Like, I use Nginx quite a bit. I've kind of been moving towards Caddy, but I still use Nginx a lot, and I've never used it. Like I said, I've seen it with a couple CTFs, but that is all. So I totally get the kind of overlook on there. And it is a bit of an ask also to be in the position to add these snippets and to actually set these annotations. However, being able to send annotation really shouldn't give you access to do code. Because, like, an annotation is just, like, this little bit of extra note data, usually about, like, whatever the node is or something. You know, you'll see in cloud where people associate maybe, like, a project ID with their node, so they can, like, query everything by the annotation. This is functionality being implemented through annotations, which also happens. But it's very much inside their scope to protect from, because, like, their application is this handling. But I have to imagine, like, this sort of attack in the wild would have to be, like, an insider attack. Or, I mean, pretty late chain, like, once they've already managed to compromise something and then using this, it's not going to... I doubt it's going to be something that's, like, exploited in mass in the wild just because of that degree of access. But they did get a $2,500 bounty out of it, which is a pretty decent bounty for the issue, I think.
Yeah, I was just about to call that out, that, you know, despite the fact that it may seem like you need some access to pull it off, they still rated it as a high severity issue. So, you know, it's definitely still recognized as a problem. But
yeah, like, within the context of the application, it is an issue and it is something to be dealt with. Like, it's within the threat model of this application, which is only largely being used in that more internal sense. I did try and look at how exactly they got the high severity on it, but unfortunately it's all it shows on here is none for, like, everything. I'm not sure. Because they show severity high 7.6, but it's not actually showing how that calculation came to be. Although I'm saying that and... Yeah, okay, I just need to click on the CVE ID over here and we get the actual vector, so network, yeah. I mean, privilege required low feels a little bit off to me. Like, because it does feel high, maybe in this context they'll say it's low. But that's the only one that kind of stands out to me and is probably part of what makes this one a high rating. Besides the fact that you're getting code execution. I mean, they know the application better. It does, to me, that feels like a high thing, but I guess they have a different opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even bother trying to, you know, think about what goes into the CVSS scores, because it's just so, like, open to interpretation in a lot of them, so, yeah. Yeah,
and even more with the CVSS 4 just launched a bit ago.
Yeah, I remember you soapboxing with that a little bit. All right, so we'll get into our last topic here, which is a post by 3Doc Security. And it's a post about testing methodology. So the whole premise of this post is about basically using unit testing type approach to auditing. So one quote that I want to pull out here is in the bias section where it says, have you ever looked at the code you were auditing, then glanced at the test and thought, wow, these folks did a really good job at testing. This area seems well tested. It will take me ages before I find a low severity issue. And then basically just skipping that area because you think it's already been well tested, which I think is a common bias. Like, it's definitely one that I've had before in the past too. And basically this post is him overcoming this bias. So he gets into what they call happy path testing, which is a methodology where you try to, like, you look at a particular area, you find all the entry points that deal with that area, similar functionalities that relate to it, and then try to come up with the most basic testing setup to, you know, be able to call a particular function, which they call the happy path. And then they say that the most important part there is any failure that you encounter. So whenever you have problems, it forces you to go through this process of like, okay, why is it not working? Is it because I didn't set something up correctly? Did I not get the state into an issue where the state into a place where it should be? And basically by going through this process, you're able to figure out all of the assumption, or like most of the assumptions that's being made by the code that you're looking at. You're able to figure out the like context and nuances of the code base. And yeah, like just that process can be very useful. And they say that we, like, here's another quote, we auditors are developers too, so we too have our own blind spots, but since we are not the same people who coded our blind spots, we'll not be completely overlapping with the project developers. Basically commenting on the fact that these tests that you see inside of a project are generally being written by the same people who wrote the code in the first place. So it's very easy for when you're writing these tests on your own code to just get into like a tunnel vision where you're just like, I know the types of problems I tried to account for. Let's just test to make sure I accounted for them properly. And you might not even be thinking of some of the other assumptions that you're making that could be broken. So the idea there is, even if you see a bunch of tests already in the project, you as someone from the outside will potentially be able to spot issues that the developer wasn't even thinking of. So yeah, this whole post basically goes through that methodology, talking about the blind spots, some of their process with talking about how they typically spend the first 2 to 3 days testing in a 1 week audit, while also ramping up their understanding. And then talking about how you take in the context of the project. For example, like some projects are really good for fuzzing, can yield a lot of results, and other ones maybe aren't so great for trying to find things through fuzzing. And those kinds of nuances you can figure out by going through this kind of methodology. So I do really like it. I think it does overlap with some points that we've brought up in the past, especially with like the human in the loop type approach, which C has mentioned before. So yeah, I did want to shout this out because I think it does have some useful tips for auditing in terms of methodology. And I'm guessing you would probably agree with that, right, C?
Yeah, generally, I think it's a good post. When I was doing a lot more of the, well, I guess, auditing or working as a consultant, I mean, a lot of my projects would serve some. I will say that a 1 week engagement feels insanely short. And then, you know, just spending, because the author here, would usually spend like the first 2 or 3 days mostly focused on testing, not necessarily security testing, but doing kind of like his happy path test, where I would get in with the code, depending on the type of project, but I try and almost write like my own Python client to like whatever application I was using. And that just forced me to figure out how to call all of these different features, how to use the website, and it would automate it so I can then like run some automated testing and have that run through my own kind of setup there. But it would force me to go through that, get that happy path working everywhere. And that's also kind of forced me to get that understanding of the application, to use it, to see what information it's taking. Especially that information it's taking can sometimes be surprising, where it's like, why is this method expecting me to include this other thing? Like, what's going on there and why? And you can play around with like removing different parameters or whatever, but starting with the happy path is kind of, I think, a good approach. And starting with that, this is just how it works, and then deviating from there and seeing what happens and what's unexpected. Not necessarily like a problem, but you make the, you know, you have your test and it's like, this isn't what I expected it to do. Not necessarily wrong, but it gives you that little point where your intuition can kick in and be like, Something's going on here, and you can dig more into it from there. Which, if you're only going around just testing, is there XSS and trying all your XSS payloads or trying all your SSTI payloads or something, like, you don't really get into this and you don't really find those deeper issues. With what you were talking about with, like, or with the fuzzing, or it kind of comes up here too, but fuzzing is an interesting, because fuzzing is good at finding some issues, but not good at others. And also, even if you have fuzzing, like, it's really easy for fuzzing to not be set up very well, not get very deep, and just oftentimes it's very easy to improve fuzzing when you're approaching it from the attacker perspective. And when it comes to testing, actually, one big thing is, you know, a lot of developers kind of learn to write the tests for their code as they're writing their code. As you were saying, you do have that bias, but it also is missing a lot of the integration testing. What happens if these two different functions are being tested at the same time and doing things, interacting with the same data at the same time? Those sort of races and anything that deals with the integration between things is just kind of another case of, like, that gets overlooked when it comes to just having good tests. I'll actually be honest, I don't think I've necessarily walked away from a lot of places where it's like, oh, they have great testing here, I'm not going to find anything, because, I don't know, maybe just my background, I wouldn't even, a lot of times wouldn't even look to see if they had good testing going on. Most of my projects would start with a call with the developers where I could ask, like, what's your testing, what are you doing for that, what type issues are you concerned about? In getting their insight. If you're doing bug bounty, you're not going to have that sort of access, and you're also not necessarily going to have access to all the code, and you can still apply this even if you're not necessarily reading the code and being able to see, like, oh, they have these tests. You can still kind of apply these same ideas of, like, the happy path and working from there still. So yeah, I like this post, and I thought it would be just kind of a quick launch into a bit of a further discussion just about the auditing and about doing some of the testing.
I think that's a good point and a thing to consider, is that there is a difference too between doing, like, the consulting where you've been brought in by the company. You're probably being brought in earlier on before a lot of that testing is done, as opposed to being on the outside doing more bug bounty type stuff. So I think this methodology probably is more applicable to the latter, where you're on the outside. If you're bedded in with the company and you're able to talk with the developers and all that,
I think just,
you know, some of this might not be as super relevant.
I think it's actually still quite relevant. The main difference is you have a lot more information to work from in terms of your guidance when you're able to talk with them. But I mean, coming from a bounty perspective, like, you lose some information, but, like, the process itself that's here is still more or less just fine, or can still be applied in some case of bounty. I know some hunters do prefer to just look like they've got their one, like, high severity issue that they're just going to look for and become very good at hunting that one issue, which is totally fair. In bug bounty, you're trying to optimize the time spent with the actual money from the bounty, so that is fair. You know, on the consulting side, we're trying to offer, you know, the clients a more comprehensive test, so the incentives are a bit different there, but you could still apply this idea, I think, easily into bug bounty, or at least this idea as I'm understanding it. And I could just be misunderstanding something and running or kind of embedding my own bias into it, I guess.
Yeah, but just being aware of the biases that exist and challenging them is really important, I feel like, for auditing. So even just in that respect, I think this post is a good reminder of that.
Yeah, I'd agree there.
Yeah. All right, so unless you have any last-minute thoughts, see, we'll wrap it up there, because that's all the topics we have for today.
No, unfortunately, this is a bit of a shorter episode.
Yeah, just how it goes sometimes, but yeah. As always, thanks to everyone who tuned in. Previous episodes can be found up on Twitch, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more links on Anchor. Our Discord and Twitter links are down below or in the chat. And with that said, we'll be back tomorrow for the binary episode, and we'll see you all then.